You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, Hugo phones home. Chavez squashes rumours of his death by calling Venezuelan state television. But what would a world be like without him? Before he dashes out of the door tonight, design editor Hugo MacDonald gives us a preview of the Designs of the Year Awards in London. As this month's Monocle focuses on the Japanese devotion to their dogs, we talk to a premium London pet shop owner about doggy grooming. And panic not, dear Midori House listener. We talk to an expert who can answer all those burning questions you've ever had about bananas. All that plus a song or two right here on Midori House, here on Monocle 24. So lots to pack in the next 60 minutes. Before that, let's get the latest news headlines from James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The White House has called on Sudan to stop its bombing raids of newly independent South Sudan and said the neighbouring countries need to return to the negotiating table to avoid escalation. A spokesman said Washington strongly condemned Sudan's military incursion into South Sudan and must immediately halt its aerial and artillery bombardment. Weeks of fighting between the countries have raised the possibility of full-blown conflict in a region with one of the most significant oil reserves in Africa. State media and opposition groups in Syria say that three soldiers have been killed and at least three others wounded in a car bomb in the capital Damascus. The incident comes as a further blow to the fragile UN-monitored ceasefire that's been in place since the 12th of April. Meanwhile, satellite imagery has shown that the Syrian government forces have not withdrawn all their heavy weaponry from cities, something the UN peace envoy Kofi Annan says is unacceptable. A security guard is the latest witness to describe the trauma of seeing last July's car bomb blast set off by Anders Behring Breivik at Norway's government headquarters. The man, Tor Inger Christoffersen, told the Oslo court he was watching on CCTV as a van parked and a man wearing what looked like a guard's uniform got out. Mr. Christoffersen described how he zoomed his camera in on the van's number plate. Moments later, eight people died when it exploded. Ex-News International chairman James Murdoch has been speaking at a high-profile judicial inquiry into Britain's press culture, set up in the wake of revelations that the News of the World illegally hacked into phone messages. Mr. Murdoch was quizzed closely by counsel for the inquiry Robert Jay on his links with British government minister Jeremy Hunt and whether there was a surreptitious element to their contact via mobile phone.
I didn't take it to mean surreptitiously. I took it to mean that maybe a small telephone call, he wanted to speak to you, would be fine. But there was no understanding in my mind that a telephone call would replace a meeting that was to be substantive where we could make the case that we wanted to make.
The French socialist presidential candidate François Hollande has suggested that some people voted on Sunday for the far right because of social anger. Mr. Hollande won the first round of the election, narrowly beating Conservative Nicolas Sarkozy, while the National Front's Marine Le Pen came third. Mr. Sarkozy, who faces a runoff election with Mr. Hollande on the 6th of May, said he had heard Le Pen voters. Uncertainty over France's future direction unsettled markets on Monday in France. Three Jewish settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank have been granted legal status by an Israeli ministerial committee. The move will help Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's standing in the coalition. He's come under fire by his own Likud party for not being committed to the settlers. But it's angered Palestinians who accused the Prime Minister of pushing the peace process into a dead end. The Israeli human rights organisation Yesh Din, who helped Palestinians petition the court over ownership, says the land on which the Beit El settlement was constructed was seized from the Palestinian village of Dura al-Kara in 1970 for military purposes. Lawyer Shlomi Zakari said he was waiting for the government's ultimatum to expire on the 1st of May.
We in Yesh Din expect that the government of the State of Israel, which is democracy, enforce the law, even though it is not a very pleasant enforcement. In our point of view in Yesh Din, the fact that law enforcement is subject to political consideration is something that undermines the rule of law, especially in such a neglected zone like the West Bank.
The Kuwaiti government has said it plans to pass laws to regulate the use of social networking sites such as Twitter. The announcement comes in the wake of cases of alleged blasphemy and sectarianism that have prompted protests. Kuwaiti lawmakers have also voted in favour of a legal amendment which could make insulting God and the Prophet Muhammad punishable by death. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. It's 5 minutes past six here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Da Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanaria.
The proper Jalabat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. When all went quiet with Hugo Chavez for 9 days, people began to worry. Questions began to be asked about what a Venezuela without the president might look like and how the wider world would respond. And with an election scheduled for October, the issue grew in urgency. Senor Chavez, however, you'll be relieved to hear, is indeed alive, although not very well. But he has resumed his vigorous tweeting from his Cuban hospital, where he's receiving a latest round of treatment for cancer. He's sent hugs to Colombia and sung the praises of his fish lunch within the last 24 hours. Well, for more on this, we now call Monocle's woman in Caracas, Sarah Granger. A very warm welcome back, Sarah, to Midori House. Hugo Chavez went quiet for quite some time. Do we know why?
Not really. I mean, he did say when he went for this latest round of radiotherapy, this is the third or fourth time that he's been to Cuba in the last few weeks, he did say that this would be a longer absence because he was going to have two sort of treatments in one, if you like. So he would be away for more than his customary 4 or 5 days, and now he's been absent from the country for well over a week. So we were expecting that he would be off the radar, but you know, he's been so secretive about certain aspects of his illness and his treatment, and he's insisted on having almost all his treatment in Cuba, that when he doesn't appear in person or he doesn't phone up the state television, he doesn't appear in voice or anything like that, then questions start to be asked and people become quite suspicious.
And when you say questions were asked, what was the reaction in Venezuela?
Well, from an opposition point of view, they were very critical of his absence for such a long time, and also critical of the fact that he would just use social media like Twitter to actually sort of keep people informed of what was going on and laws he was supposedly signing and work that he was supposedly doing. And there was no other presence of the president whatsoever. So the opposition had been quite critical. I think for his supporters, you know, they've gotten used over the last few weeks to seeing much less of him, and that calls into question his ability to really run as the candidate for the government in the upcoming elections, because if his absences like this continue, I think, you know, some people will begin to question whether he's able to carry on and serve a further six-year term, and if he's really able to govern the country when obviously his health problems and his treatment are taking up so much of his time and energy.
You mentioned there that the opposition was keen to jump on Chavez's perceived weakness in his absence. Has that been well received, or are people just assuming that is another part of electioneering?
I think that it is seen as electioneering, and it's seen, you know, depending on what your point of view is, you see it either as the opposition making a fair point, or you see it as you know, rather unfairly taking a jibe at the president when he's not very well. The president himself yesterday, when he did finally sort of appear, and he appeared in voice at a press conference held by his Socialist Party here in Caracas, he actually said, you know, we're going to have to expect more of this speculation and this fear-mongering as we approach the elections. And he's very much playing it as if that's what the opposition is trying to do. But the opposition has sort of shied away from doing it too much. You know, they don't, I think they don't really want to be seen, you know, if they were to win this election with Chavez so sick and they, you know, a great part of their success were put down to his illness, I don't think they'd see that really as a success. They want to sort of go to the polls and if they do win, to have won fairly and squarely.
Much, though, has been made by Enrique Capriles, Chavez's main rival for the need for fresh life at the head of Venezuela. If the worst were to come to the worst and Chavez should die, do you think, where would that leave Venezuela politically?
In a tricky situation, because the problem for his socialist party and his government is that he's refused to appoint anyone as a successor, and he's refused really, you know, even non-explicitly to sort of hint at or to kind of nurture one particular person who might take over from him. So for his party, if he were to die, you know, in the next couple of weeks, it would be extremely difficult. They'd have to muster support for one person to stand as their candidate. Whether that's even possible, who knows? Maybe there would be an awful lot of infighting. And even if they put forward a new candidate at this stage, you know, Capriles has already had several months of campaigning. His profile's been growing as the one opposition candidate. So for someone to come in to try to step into Chavez's shoes and to oppose Capriles at this point, I think would be difficult. So that's the first, would be the first issue for his party. And then for the country, you'd be looking at, as of October, certainly you'd be looking at a whole new regime, whether that would be a Chavez successor or Capriles as the opposition. And that would throw up a whole other bunch of questions as to what direction the country would take. Even if it was a socialist president who took over, you know, would he take the so-called socialist revolution in the same direction as Chavez has been doing? And I think without knowing who his successor might be, it's impossible to say what the future would hold.
There is also the issue of where the country would be positioned within South America, because other countries would lose key ally, you know, the key ally of Chavez. I'm thinking of Argentina, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Politically, Chavez is very much a supporter of, for instance, Argentina and their complaint over the Falkland Islands, the Islas Malvinas, as they call them, and also of other regional presidents, Ecuador, Nicaragua, who sort of align with Chavez and his left-wing agenda. Another issue economically, the Venezuelan government has Petrocaribe, this mechanism whereby it gives very cheap oil to a lot of smaller nations in the region, particularly in the Caribbean, and particularly Cuba as well. And so all of those countries would have to ask themselves, you know, would that deal continue? Would the terms change? Would they suddenly be faced with a huge debt to Venezuela that they would have to pay back? So I think a lot of uncertainty in the region.
And once we've looked at, you know, once we've considered the South American question, we then have to think outside, and the Venezuelan position on the global stage. Immediately one thinks of the very close relationship that Venezuela has with Iran. Do you think that could be maintained at the same level and degree of closeness?
I think, again, it would depend on who we have taking over, and I couldn't see a Capriles, an opposition government, supporting Iran in the way that Chavez has. I think, you know, Iran is just too unpopular on the world stage for Capriles, who is much more a centrist than Chavez, to take that risk. So obviously that would be one relationship that you know, would be under threat from a change in regime here in Venezuela. But there are others as well. I mean, Chavez was a huge fan of Gaddafi. He's a fan of lots of unpopular regimes, Belarus, Russia. He has very good links with China, Syria also. Venezuela's been sending petrol to Syria throughout the whole Syrian crisis. So I think there'll be lots of different governments in lots of different corners of the world who have a lot to think about in terms of Chavez's health and you know, what his potential absence could mean for them.
I mean, the fact that we're having this conversation now, Chavez has just re-emerged after a 9-day absence, but here we are discussing a possible world without Chavez. Is that possibly a sign that maybe we need to hear a little bit more about what exactly is wrong with Hugo Chavez, the nature and the severity of his cancer?
I think that's why, you know, that's why a 9-day absence began to spark rumours of his death, because he has been so secretive about it. And also initially, if you remember last year, in June last year, he went missing for something like 3 weeks, and we barely heard from him for 3 weeks. And that was when he finally came out and admitted, okay, you know, I've had this treatment and they found a tumor and it's cancer. But, you know, there's obviously been this reluctance to be completely truthful with the public and completely honest about what's going on. So there is this degree of suspicion, and I don't think it's just something on the part of the opposition. I think that, you know, lots of people feel in the dark about it, and it suits his purposes to not give all the details out and to play things close to his chest and have things up his sleeve, but you know, I wonder also if it will backfire on him, because people will begin to ask questions about his health and about what he's capable of. And, you know, if he keeps doing that up to the elections, it could cost him the election.
So finally and briefly, you mentioned the elections there. Do you think that the elections will be able to be held credibly and legitimately with a desperately ill candidate?
That's, another big unknown. I was speaking to a constitutional expert last week, and there are so many different possible scenarios. And as the illness develops or doesn't develop, you know, the government has lots of different options about replacing their candidate. They could do that, you know, sort of almost right up until the election. They could try to postpone the election. So, you know, as things stand, you'd say, you know, Chavez's health needs to improve so he can really get out on the campaign trail. But there are so many possibilities about how the government could handle this that we could be looking at, you know, no elections in October or you know, a completely different candidate in a few months' time.
Sarah Granger in Caracas, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. It's just coming up to 16 minutes past the hour.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Stay with us because later in the programme we'll be exploring a crisis in the world's banana crop. And so to commemorate this, we have some music, suitably named Tropicalia by Beck. That was Tropicalia by Beck. You're listening to Midori House. It's 90 minutes past the hour. Tonight in London, the design crowd is to flock south of the river for the announcement of this year's Victorious Designs of the Year. From a not-so-short list of 89 objects created over the last 12 months, winners will be chosen in 7 categories. And one lucky thing will be crowned Overall Design of the Year. Well, on tonight's Monocle Daily, our design editor Hugo MacDonald will be phoning in to deliver the results from the event. Earlier, though, before he set off, he sat down with Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove to try his hand at a bit of design crystal ball game.
So, Hugo, I'm very jealous you're off to the Design Awards tonight.
I am. It's the Designs of the Year announcement at the annual Design Awards. Design of the Year exhibition. Sorry, I said design about 16 times. It's always quite difficult to
push that message across. Whereabouts is this design extravaganza happening?
It happens at the London Design Museum, which is in Shad Thames, just south of the river. This is its 5th year, and actually it's really sort of found its feet in that it gathers together a ridiculous amount. I think there's 89 products in total that span everything from huge Zaha Hadid buildings in China to tiny little wooden huts in sort of unused spaces in London, and everything that you can think of in between across graphic design, interactive design, furniture design, transport design. And it sort of tries to give a cross-section of everything that's happened in the last year. Whittling that down. I know it is. It's a big task. And whittling that down to a winner in each of the 6 categories, and then an overall winner is quite a monumental task that the judges will be doing actually as we speak, and the winners will be announced in a couple of hours.
How tricky. Now, I want to tackle one of the first and most important categories, architecture.
Yes.
Who are you rooting for?
I am rooting for Hopkins Architects Velodrome, which is past the Olympic site. And I know that we were speaking about this on Midori House last week, but to me, it is a real sort of beautiful emblem of proper architecture, very sustainable, very beautiful to look at, employs all sorts of sort of traditional craft, and a lot of sort of British small companies have been involved in putting it together.
Such the jewel in the crown of the Olympic site.
It really is. It's a sort of complete gift to the London landscape. And for all that Zaha Hadid's Aquatic Centre might be spectacular and the Shard might be grabbing all the headlines, Hopkins Architects are a husband and wife team. I think they're from Norfolk in England. And they've just been quietly building these absolutely beautifully finished, sort of small but very impressive, long-lasting buildings throughout Britain. And when they were commissioned to do the Velodrome for the Olympic site, I was thrilled because it's an opportunity for them to sort of step into the spotlight. I'm really hoping that they will win the architecture category.
I love those husband and wife duo architects.
I went to see a talk that they gave last year and they stood on stage and bickered for about half an hour.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, finishing each other's sentences and then telling each other off.
Also, we should say Chipperfield is up there with the Hepworth Gallery, which is really beautiful.
Another very, very beautiful space.
Up in Wakefield.
Exactly. And, I mean, that would also be a worthy winner, but I don't know, there's something about the underdog of Hopkins, and the architecture industry will be up in arms with me saying that. Everybody sort of knows who David Chipperfield is. I don't think people are so familiar with Hopkins Architects.
And there were some wild cards on the list. I was looking at this amazing project to rework the iron market in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Exactly.
You sort of get the sense that this award is really sort of, you know, sometimes it's given to the stars already, and sometimes it's trying to sort of shed some light on projects no one would ever hear about.
Absolutely. That's sort of what I mean when I say that I feel like in its 50th year, the Design Museum's Design Awards have found their footing, because although the list of nominations seems so huge and exhaustive and disparate, they're very good at picking out the things that, you know, don't get attention elsewhere. There are always some obvious things in there. The Iron Market in Haiti by John McCaslin and Partners is an amazing sort of project that has breathed life into Haiti. Like, they have resurrected what was sort of the city's sort of emblem of industry. And although it has quite a sort of colonial heritage, it's a really, really beautiful structure. And only less than 2 years after the disaster struck Haiti, they have managed to completely resurrect it and turn it into sort of something that has a foot in the past, but also sort of actually operates much better as a centre of sort of industry and commerce in the city. And a project like that really does deserve to sort of be given more attention than it has been.
What about digital? That's an interesting category for the design world. I know one of the nominees, United Visual Artists, they were on Midori House with their incredible High Arctic installation at Greenwich. And it was amazing sort of, it was Svalbard, which we're also obsessed with by Monocle 24. It's amazing sort of snowy, crazy place with all these polar bears roaming. And they sort of recreated it. I think they deserve to win for that.
Digital is always one of the sort of more difficult ones to get a grip on, because it takes in everything from sort of website design to app design to we've got sort of all sorts of iPad editions and things in there. I have to say, in the exhibition, it's one that I tend to skim over because I can't be bothered to sit and tap on an iPad just to find out if it's good. But I think what you've singled out, United Visual Artists, I would say that they probably stand a very good chance of winning. One very interesting one, though, in that category as well, is the Home Plus, which is South Korea's, or Tesco's South Korean arm. They've created a virtual store in underground stations in Seoul, where commuters go and they do their supermarket shopping on a screen, and it's delivered the same day to their home. That's an experiment that Tesco have done. It's been amazingly successful there.
Well, I hope they recreate screaming children and also queues and vile lighting. That's what I'd like to...
I think the idea is that they strip all of that out and make it as simple for people to do their grocery shopping as possible.
So what about fashion?
Well, fashion is quite controversial because... Kate Middleton's wedding dress is in there. And when the shortlist was announced, it was just billed as Kate Middleton's wedding dress rather than Sarah Burton's wedding dress for the Duchess of Cambridge. And, you know, it's a very, very sort of populist entry. It's probably more than any of the other 89 things being the one that's had the most attention in the press.
I mean, it's typical, really, of these slightly... It's a gesture and it's an interesting moment for Sarah Burton. Because, you know, she's taken over, you know, really quite a tough job. It does slightly offend some people in the design community because it's not a very meritocratic decision, considering that the dress isn't a design innovation. It's
exactly.
A beautiful, classic dress. It's a kind of atavistic design, really. It doesn't move fashion on in any sense.
No, and you've completely hit upon the point that everybody brings up to criticise this event, is that... You know, for all that you do have celebration of innovation and things that really are furthering or pushing forward the way that we live today, you then throw something like that in just to ensure that you get the column inches. And it slightly undermines the good of the rest of it. I'd be surprised if it won. I'd be very disappointed if it won in that category. I think it's more for what it represents for McQueen. But like you say, that Sarah Burton's come in at a very difficult time but has managed to not just to do a good job, but really push the brand forward and turn it into a business.
And we should say that in the fashion category, there's some quite interesting stuff there. Vivian Westwood, I'm a fan of Westwood, and she did an ethical fashion collection, all made in Africa, which has really changed the industry in that sense, because she's such a pioneer, and all the designs were so, not this kind of sort of, you know, handcrafted ethos. It was all kind of amazing, asymmetrical, crazy Westwood, beautiful like things, engineering feats that she does with her clothes. So it'll be quite interesting to see if she gets anywhere with that. But what are your other favourites? I mean, we don't have too much time left, and it'd be great to just get some, you know, skim over some of the ones that you're excited about.
Well, in the furniture category, there's somebody who I've been rooting for, who's a Korean designer at the RCA. And his graduate project was an entire furniture range made of balsa wood, but constructed in such a way that it can take the weight, not just of human, but, you know, much, much more, a very, very heavy human. And the furniture is incredibly light and it's beautiful. It's very sort of clean and simple, and the kind of furniture that you would definitely want to live with in your home. Very easy to put together, but it's just sort of interesting that he has taken on a material that is cheap and sustainable and done something that, you know, all the millions of designers that I saw in Milan last year have never thought to do. I think that that's exactly the kind of thing that we should be celebrating in these design awards. Likewise, there's a fantastic, in transport, the readers are in amidst all the electric cars that always crop up, which, you know, it's nice to think that that might be the source of transport of tomorrow, but they never really seem to sort of become reality.
Get going.
Exactly. It's a bit of a non-starter. There's a redesign of the ambulance, which is amazing. Again, it comes from the RCA, this time from the Helen Hamlin Centre for Design and Vehicle Design. And what it does is it just sort of rethinks about how the ambulance can treat more people rather than just being a vehicle of transport to ship people to hospitals. And so it's more spacious, it's much cleaner, much easier to clean, and it has more room for equipment. And it says that it will cut people being delivered to hospital by 60%.
I suppose this is the essence of what, you know, we really want to see at the Design Awards, when something is so practical, but also can have those aesthetic values that we want to see. And the one that we were really excited about when we were glancing through the list is the robot for sort of finding mines and detonating mines. A terrible job and with such risk. And it's a little bamboo robot.
Exactly.
That could be a contender for some sort of category. I'm not sure.
Again,
which
I'm rooting for that one as well.
And it's just so great to see that those two things, when practicality and sort of beauty come together like that.
Therein you have the essence of design, Sophie.
Thanks. I'll just sum that up for you. Just in case, design editor, you didn't realise what you're dealing with.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I'm actually going to be catching up live on the daily from the Design Museum to deliver the awards, the announcements. Not to deliver the awards themselves, but to tell you who's won.
Well,
so tune in
exciting.
Later at about 10:30 for that.
And that was our own design editor, Hugo MacDonald, and our essence of design, Sophie Grove, giving us a preview of tonight's Design of the Year Awards. And as Hugo has just mentioned, you can hear him provide us with live check-ins from the awards tonight on the Monocle Daily. That's airing at around 10:30 p.m., 22:30 p.m. London time. You're listening to Midori House, where it's 31 minutes past the hour. Time now to get some news from James Luckhurst.
The White House has called on Sudan to stop its bombarding raids of newly independent South Sudan and said the neighbouring countries needed to return to the negotiating table to avoid escalation. A spokesman said Washington strongly condemns Sudan's military incursion into South Sudan and must immediately halt its aerial and artillery bombardment. State media and opposition groups in Syria say that three soldiers have been killed and at least three others wounded in a car bomb in the capital Damascus. The incident comes as a further blow to the fragile UN-monitored ceasefire that's been in place since the 12th of April. A security guard is the latest witness to describe the trauma of seeing last July's car bomb blast set off by Anders Behring Breivik at Norway's government headquarters. The man told the Oslo court he was watching on CCTV as a van parked and a man wearing what looked like a guard's uniform got out. Moments later, the van exploded, killing eight people. The French socialist presidential candidate François Hollande has suggested that some people voted on Sunday for the far right because of social anger. Mr. Hollande won the first round of the election, narrowly beating conservative Nicolas Sarkozy, while the National Front's Marine Le Pen came third. And the Kuwaiti government has said it plans to pass laws to regulate the use of social networking sites such as Twitter. The announcement comes in the wake of cases of alleged blasphemy and sectarianism that have prompted protests. And those are the latest headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, James. James will be back in just a little under 30 minutes to bring us a full roundup of today's headlines. And stay with us on Midori House, because in the next half hour, we'll be examining what threats lie ahead for the humble banana, and we'll get an update on the Glasgow International Festival of Visual Arts. But first, if you are to pick up the latest edition of Monocle, that is issue 53, you will see an image of a modern Japanese family unit. There is a neat, pretty woman. At her side, a well-groomed gentleman, and cradled lovingly in his arms, an arguably even better groomed little dog. Health and hair care and general canine well-being is very big business in Japan. And at 12 million, there are almost as many dogs in the country as there are children. Well, of course, any well-heeled urban dog lover across the world knows the importance of grooming. And to talk a little bit more about the big business of dog grooming here in the United Kingdom, we're joined in the studio, I'm very pleased to say, by Jonathan Zatland from Mungo & Maud, a premium dog and cat outfitter here in London. A very warm welcome to you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you here. Just tell us what inspired you to actually get into the market of luxury dog accessories.
Well, we started the business in 2005, and we explored the market a couple of years before opening our shop in Elizabeth Street in London, and noticed there obviously was a very, very big category out there for dog-loving people who were looking to buy certain accessories to kit out their home or their dog. And but it sort of lacked what we felt was sort of stylish and of quality product that was sort of tastefully done. So we sort of came into the market as a sort of lifestyle range, catering to people with a sort of contemporary lifestyle. And we could sort of offer products that had something that had style and was of a certain quality that they felt they could work with in their homes or with their animal.
Now, you mentioned there the words style, quality, tasteful. If you look at our edition of Monocle, there is a line about a dog that emerges from a salon wearing cargo pants and a check shirt. And, you know, the word hilarity is then mentioned in the next sentence. How do you actually ensure that your products are tasteful and lovely without inspiring hilarity in others?
Well, first and foremost, we have wonderful creative director of Nicola Sacker, who is has a great team working with her, and it really is a main focus of the business to to keep things to our taste. Obviously, we've got our own voice. There is a big market, clearly, for in both in Asia and the United States and even in London, for what potentially could be termed more garish products. But we specifically wanted to enter the market not in terms of dressing up your dog. We wanted to sort of treat the dog as, which it now is, part of the home, part of your lifestyle, and try and sort of create products that we felt would be very much fall in line with how the owner would design their own homes, be it for a dog bed or if they were walking down the street with a particular lead. We felt there's no reason why it can't be something that they would want to pick up in for their own particular accessories that they would adorn themselves with.
Now, there is obviously this is enormous business, and especially in Japan, where they think nothing of spending €90 on a do for their dog. Mm. I mean, to whereabouts? Where is the rest of the world in terms of this? I mean, obviously, Japan is an absolute case apart. It's you know, they love their dogs. What about the rest of the world?
From what I know, it's obviously a very, very big category. And as I mentioned earlier, in the United States, Japan, across the UK, it's a booming business. I think, I don't get into statistics, but that you know, more and more people are either waiting to start families later, having a dog earlier in their lives sort of helps ease into that potentially. And I think, you know, it's unconditional love, and you'll obviously do anything for the dog or cat that you love.
The doggy product market in Japan is now reaching saturation point. It is no longer growing at the rate that it was a couple of years ago, and so new markets are opening up, such as cafes, hotels, funeral parlours, etc. What is happening in the likes of the United Kingdom in terms of the luxury spin-off market for dogs?
I think we're seeing more grooming parlours. We're seeing more sort of specialist services that cater to the owners and their dogs and cats. I think for us, you know, Mungo and Maud, sort of our focus is mainly on creating that sort of lifestyle accessories. Potentially would spin off into grooming and other areas further down the road. But for us, there's thankfully a big demand for, you know, more of a quality and a taste to the product that I think we have sort of been at the forefront of.
I mean, the majority of the dogs that we see in the magazine, and when one thinks of sort of accessorised dogs, is sort of toy poodles, chihuahuas, Pomeranians, Dachshunds, what have you. Mm. Is it generally the little dog market, or are you, in a more, if I were to say quite flippantly, you're not trying to put a lurcher in a dress or something like that?
No. We definitely don't dress up the dogs. And we cater to all sizes. We don't discriminate.
When you say you don't dress up the dogs, your website does have lots of pictures of dogs in sweaters.
Indeed.
They're lovely sweaters.
Yes.
They're beautiful, lovely merino wool, nice. I mean, enviable pieces of clothing, but you say this is not dressing up a dog.
That particular category, when it gets into clothing, is obviously clearly more geared towards a smaller dog, because some of them do get cold and some of them do get extremely wet in the pouring rain. So when we sort of look at that category, we try and do everything again. You know, I hate to mention the word taste again, but we do try and very much focus on on the taste and the quality. Our sort of coats, you know, are water resistant, and we use, you know, quality merino wools and cashmere. And I think if a dog owner is out there looking for this category, then Mungo More can cater to it in what we see as a stylish and
And as the Japanese reach saturation point, where do you think the British market is going to go next? Very briefly.
I think it's still in its infancy compared to other markets. I think it's got a long way to go.
Jonathan, thank you very much
indeed.
Thank you. That was Jonathan Zatland from Mungo and Maud telling us about the world of doggy grooming. And of course, you can find all about the amazing world of Japanese dogs and their lifestyle, their spa-based lifestyles, in issue 53 of Monocle. Stay with us, because in a moment we'll be discussing the very imperiled fruit, the banana.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
this store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Stay with us, because in the next 20 minutes we'll be talking to the organiser of one of Glasgow's best international arts fairs. But before that, pity the poor banana. Who would have thought such drama lay behind the fruit bowl stalwart? It's a cloned fruit, for starters, meaning it can't reproduce naturally, poor thing. Now, however, it's under threat from a killer fungus. Banana growers are engaged in a desperate race to keep this particular strain going. The fear is, though, that if the fungus hits the South American crops, the whole of the United States supply could be under threat. Well, to tell us more, joining me now is the man who wrote the book about bananas, Dan Kerpel. Very warm welcome to Midori House. Tell us about this fungus. How bad is it?
Well, the fungus appeared in the early 1990s in Asia. It spread throughout Asia south and has now destroyed the entire banana crop in the Philippines and is rampaging through Australia, causing millions of dollars worth of damage there.
So how big of a swathe of the banana crop is it actually destroying in terms of proportion of the global crop?
It's hard to say. The Cavendish banana, which is the commercial banana we're talking about 60% of the global crop. In some countries, for example, Malaysia, 100% of their crop has been wiped out. Other countries have done better, but the bottom line is that once this fungus hits, it's game over. It's a matter of time because there's no cure, no way to stop it.
So if this now hits South America, I mentioned in my cue just then that it could wipe out the United States banana crop supply. That's very, very serious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's serious. But it's also important to remember that this commercial banana is just one of about 1,000 varieties of bananas that we don't get to eat. And the disease also strikes subsistence bananas. So, for example, in places like Uganda, where some people get 90% of their calories from bananas, that crop is under threat too. So you've got not just economic issues, but starvation issues.
Now, we currently eat the Cavendish banana. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I can say that it's the most ubiquitous and most boring banana on the planet. In India, it's known as the hotel banana because it's only served to people in hotels. It's very easy to ship, very easy to grow, except for these diseases that strike it, which makes it a sort of the McDonald's hamburger of bananas. It's bland, it's boring, but it's ubiquitous and cheap.
So, I mean, the obvious question is why not actually create a banana that is more resistant to this fungus?
Attempts to do that. The problem is that a banana is actually not a very logical fruit to ship to northern climates. It's quite fragile. It's quite perishable. And so in order to get a banana that you can actually get to supermarkets, you really need to build in a lot of qualities, durability, ripenability, that are hard to actually genetically modify or even find in other banana varieties. The Cavendish of all those thousands is the only one at this point that fits that commercial bill.
Now, you also have this added problem that the banana cannot propagate itself, can it? All these little boxes in terms of taste and resilience have to be ticked by the banana propagators, the human being. We've had lots and lots of previous strains of banana. Take us back a little bit through history to tell us what our forefathers will have eaten.
If you're talking about the banana growing region, the banana regions of the world, the banana is an absolutely key crop in the history of human expansion. It's so portable, it's so durable that it went with us as we traveled the world, and we're talking tens of thousands of years. It helped us invent agriculture. And so in India, you've still got village bananas, over 600 varieties, some of which are absolutely delicious. Thailand as well. In Africa, which a banana is not native to, but it's been around for 2,000 years, you've got plantains as long as your arm. You've got red bananas, spotted bananas. There's just insane variety, none of which we ever see at our markets in the U.S. or the U.K. or anywhere else in the northern world.
So why are we so restricted to the example, which is yellow and bendy?
It's because of that shipability problem. All of these other great bananas, I can tell you about a banana that's called Ibota Ibota in Swahili. It means very fertile, and you get dozens of bananas per bunch. The problem is that the bananas fall off the bunch the second you touch them, and they begin to go bad quickly, so you can't ship them. Only the Cavendish has those particular qualities that let it be shipped. Again, it's like McDonald's. McDonald's is not going to sell fine food. It's not in their business model. The banana companies have this business model of making the banana the cheapest fruit in the supermarket. If you think about that, it's shipped so far, it's so perishable, yet it's really cheap. So we're talking a lowest common denominator industrial product here.
So how do we go about developing the next generation of this industrial banana?
Well, I think we've seen a great lack of imagination on the part of the big banana companies. They are looking at this disease through a sort of lens of denial, and they're looking at the Western palate through that same lens. We've seen all kinds of exotic fruit come to our shores in the past two decades, kiwi fruit, for example. And yet there's this sense that the consumer will only tolerate one boring banana. It's possible to ship these other bananas and to get them to us. They're just going to have to cost more. Are consumers willing to pay more for a really great banana? I mean, are they willing to pay more for a great bottle of wine or a great piece of cheese? I think the answer is yes, especially once people get the chance to taste these amazing different varieties.
I mean, one thing I never knew about the banana is about 10 years ago, it was under threat from another fungus. I think the fungus was called Panama. Has it always been this terrible race against fungus for the banana?
Absolutely. Panama disease, which is the fungus that's currently threatening the banana, actually was the fungus that destroyed incarnation one of the banana industry in the early 1900s. What's fascinating is we had a different lowest common denominator banana back then. It was called the Gros Michel banana. That banana was wiped out by Panama disease race one, is the technical term for it. Cavendish was only adopted because it was resistant to race one. However, a new race emerged, and so the banana that we thought was resistant actually is now susceptible. So we've got all, and there's about a dozen other major banana diseases, and because bananas are clones, because they're identical twins, what makes one banana sick makes them all sick.
Dan Capel, author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. It's 12 minutes to the top of the hour.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24, how about ya?
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 ei oikeassa.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The propagalavat. Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Afto en Monaco 24.
Det här är Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
24.
24.
24.
Welcome back to Midori House. The spotlight falls on Glasgow this week as the city plays host to some major exhibitions in its International Festival of Visual Art. Its organisers promise a unique moment in the British cultural calendar, as they've promised to turn the entire city into a work of art. The festival runs until the 7th of May, and to tell us more, I'm joined by Jean Cameron, the festival's producer. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Jean. So what does this mean, turning the city into a work of art?
Art happens all year round in Glasgow, but during the festival, artists, galleries, all take over the whole city. So one of the projects you'll know about is the Jeremy Deller Sacrilege, which is happening on Glasgow Green, which is one of the oldest pieces of common land in the city. We're also using parks in other parts of the city. Henry Coombs has taken over a park. And we like to think of the festival a bit like a cultural safari. In 2010, we had Susan Phillips's piece situated under the bridges at the Clyde that went on for to have Susan nominated for the Turner Prize, which she went on to win in 2010. So it's very much about artists seeing the city in a way that I certainly don't, and using their perspective to turn it into a big playground that brings people together in a really joyful way.
And the focus is very much on brand new or unseen art, isn't it?
It is, yeah. 90% of the work at the festival is brand new. It's commissioned specifically for the festival. That's either galleries in the city inviting international artists to come in, or it's local artists creating new projects. So yeah, you really have to be in Glasgow to see the work, although the work does go on tour elsewhere, and the Jeremy Deller Sacrilege piece we've commissioned with the Mayor of London, and that will be touring down to London during the Olympics and the Paralympics.
The Sacrilege being the enormous bouncy castle of Stonehenge that many of us will have seen in the media, is that right?
That's right, and many of us have got really sore calves from bouncing on. It's quite a workout, but it's absolutely joyful.
How did the festival come about?
Well, there's a really strong visual arts scene in Glasgow, and as you probably know, Glasgow School of Art has produced more Turner Prize winners and Turner Prize nominees than any other art school in the UK outside of London. So our local artists are very, very much international, and the festival has come from their sort of grassroots desire to have a moment to celebrate what they do in the city, where they live and work. And to show off to visitors coming in from other parts of the UK and internationally, but also to show it off to Glaswegians and people on the doorstep. There's still a story to tell to Glaswegians about the amazing visual art that goes on in the city. So it's very much rooted in the strong voice of the visual arts community approaching lobbying, if you like, various funders to say, look, this is a good thing and why don't you invest in it? And that's what we've been doing since 2005.
You've mentioned already that you're treating the city as a playground and you've enjoyed experiencing the bouncy castle feel of the Jeremy Deller. There seems to be quite a festival rhythm to the whole thing.
That's right, yes. I think that we are a biennial event, but we call ourselves a festival rather than a biennale. I guess other biennales such as Venice or Sao Paulo they have quite what we would say a splashy opening over the opening weekend, and then are probably quite static with exhibitions over a long period, whereas GI is more of a festival rhythm. We run for 3 weeks, and there's different events on offer to accompany the exhibitions every day over the 18 days. So any visitors coming into town are going to get a complete unique experience in terms of whether it's curated tours, films, gigs, DJs, theatre pieces. Each day is much more that we're vibrant than just a series of exhibitions. We really very much borrow from other art forms. So last night we had Richard Hell, who was the lead guy with television and the Voidoids, presenting an art film here in Glasgow. He's working with Jim Lambie, a local visual artist. Over the weekend we've had four theatre performances. It's a collaboration with the National Theatre of Scotland out at the Tramway, and that we've been working with Michael McDonough, who's a director of photography, who's been filming those performances, and actually we're going to make a feature-length film out of that. So there is a real legacy in other art forms as well, and I think that's very much about the character of the city. Venues like the Tramway are cross art form venues. The Arches that's taking part in the festival again are cross art forms. So artists like art bands like Franz Ferdinand, Correcto. There's a lot of artists that are also in bands. Richard Wright, who's in Correcto, is showing with us at the Kelvin Grove, and he was a Turner Prize winner in 2009. So it feels really natural to be event-based and festival.
You're clearly very proud of Glasgow and its influence on people. What do you think the city and the geographical location of Glasgow has as an influence on artists and musicians?
I think there's a real politic here, actually. Glasgow is not a capital city, and it's a city that's been through the mill in terms of transforming itself from an industrial city through to a kind of post-industrial cultural capital. As you know, we were cultural capital of Europe in 1990, but there was a really tough recession. I mean, typically, obviously, we have one now, but it was a really tough recession in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, which meant a lot of warehouse spaces were lying empty, and artists could get cheap rent and come into those and occupy it. And there was no art market. So there was nobody kind of, the artists who were occupying these spaces were experimenting, were making large-scale work, were collaborating with each other, and the currency was very much about collaboration rather than a financial currency, and they were making work that they kind of they were excited by, and the market kind of followed, and those critical accolades. 1996, Douglas Gordon was the first Glaswegian to win the Turner Prize, and the respected art critic and director of the Serpentine, Hans Ulrich Obrist, coined the phrase the Glasgow Miracle in 1996, which was very much about, you know, there's this strong scene without a market that are just producing amazing work, and there's a real spirit of DIY, self-organisation, doing it with others, which is characteristic of the city, and I think that there's a real democracy in the city. You know, Turner Prize winners are rubbing shoulders and helping, lending a hand to Glasgow School of Art students, and that really reflects the hospitality of Glasgow as a city and the grittiness of Glasgow as a city. We don't have the kind of airs and graces, I guess, of a capital city.
Jean, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That was Jean Cameron, the producer of Glasgow's International Festival of Visual Art. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Tag und Jahr.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja joukossa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
That's all for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. The show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 hours London time, that's in 3 hours, join Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller with the Monocle Daily. They'll be checking in with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, at the Design Awards. Up next, after the news, you can hear Hugo again in Section D. But from all of us on Midori House, goodbye.